Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1990, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an impresario. Over the past 30 years, he's risked hundreds of millions of his own money and other people's too, entertaining family audiences with glittering musicals. His successes are legendary. Half a Sixpence, Charlie Girl, Sweet Charity and Barnum, to name but a few. His list of stars is dazzling. He even got Frank Sinatra to play Blackpool. Like the best theatrical grandees, his failures have been on a large scale too. His production of Ziegfeld crashed 2 years ago at a loss of more than £2 million, and this year his new musical with Petula Clark closed early. Nevertheless, he remains optimistic. "My shows are the purpose of my life," he says, "and always have been." He is Harold Fielding. So how did you persuade Sinatra to come to Blackpool, Harold? With difficulty?
Well, with difficulty, but he was marvellous, and he gave me something, apart from the marvellous performance I'd never done before, the pleasure of dashing down the whole promenade at Blackpool in a police car with all the sirens blaring. And I thought that made my day. It's how I always remember Sinatra.
But that's the only way he'd go to the,
yes,
the show?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
A demand?
A demand. On a
the,
little demand.
On the contract.
Yeah, nicely put. Nicely put. I mean, Marlene Dietrich, who was another of the great stars that I introduced to Blackpool, because I did concerts there for 33 years. She was remarkable because we took her up in a very small plane, which we used most Sundays in those days, and I said, "It's only 45 minutes from where we took her." And she said, "Harold, that doesn't matter. I shall still change on the plane." Tiny, I said, "It's very difficult." She said, "Leave that to me. I will change on the plane because when I get out, there's not one single crease." And I thought that was the sheer professionalism.
So it's really been a lifetime devoted to the stars. Some people would call that masochism.
Well, it certainly ain't easy, if I may put it that way. But once you've made up your mind, you see, stars are very valuable, and you pay them an awful lot of money. It's absurd money for their performance. You pay them, to put in my very common language, bums on seats. If they have little peculiarities of their own, put up with them.
So when you pay someone like Ginger Rogers, as you did in 1969, I think,
yes,
in Maine,
yes,
you
in
paid
Maine.
Her £5,000 a week, I think.
Probably not.
How much of that was salary for what Ginger did on the stage, and how much was it for bums on seats?
Well, I always put it that you say 30 or 40% is salary for performance, and the rest is for that. I mean, she was a remarkable woman. Again, one of the most professional people. Absolutely adorable off the stage, and an absolute hell to deal with once she'd gone through the stage door. It's the only show I've ever had in my life where she had to be escorted from her dressing room. And you know, I built that marvellous dressing room all done in silk at Drury Lane for her. Each entrance she came on stage to play her part, she had to be taken by the hand and put on and expected a stage manager to be standing where she made her exit to take her back to the dressing room. But all that sort of thing, I've learned to live with. I've enjoyed it.
Well, more to come on the temperament of the stars, but let's find out more about your temperament, first of all. What kind of music will preserve your sanity on the desert island?
Serious music. I started as a violinist. If you'd said to me when I was 10, 11, "Cut your right arm off, you'll play better," I'd have cut the right arm off. I was that dedicated. I'm a very bad sleeper. I get up very often in the middle of the night, go into another room and play beautiful music. As, for example, the piece of music you're going to play first, because that is one of the most soothing pieces of music I've ever heard. And it's the Schumann Piano Concerto, played by the great pianist Solomon. And Solomon has a special memory for me because my very first professionally promoted concert was a recital by Solomon in of all places, the Hippodrome at Aldershot, which was a variety theatre and totally unsuitable, really. But Solomon then became a great friend, did hundreds of concerts for me. And he, to my mind, has that wonderful, smooth quality. And the few bars I think you're going to play from the Schumann Concerto just show that perfectly.
opening of Schumann's Piano Concerto in A minor, Opus 54, played by Solomon, with the Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Herbert Mengers. So tell me, Harold Fielding, about you and this violin as a boy. How did it all happen?
Well, it all happened because when I was 6, 7 and was shut in the room to practice the piano, I hated it. In fact, I got very severely told off by my parents. They said, "We'll give you a violin later." I said, "No, now. Please, please." And it wasn't until I was 10 that Daddy said one morning, "Taking you to London, I'm going to buy you a violin." Bought it on the store for £1 in Wardour Street, wrapped up in newspaper. We took it back to Woking, where I lived in the family home, took it out on the scrubbed kitchen table that you used to have in those days, and I could play. Now, that convinced me absolutely that there is reincarnation. I did not have to be shown how to hold a bow, and that, you know, is usually at least 6 months of agony. And I could literally play.
What did you play?
And I could just play the violin. I couldn't play any particular piece, but I could manipulate it and play it. And I started to study straight away, and within a year, 18 months, I was giving recitals. And it was the most wonderful experience. I absolutely adored it. You know, it was a wonderful career. I got taken all over the country.
You were billed, weren't you, as England's wonder boy violinist?
I'm afraid I was. Isn't it awful?
What did you wear to perform?
In fact, sometimes billed as England's young Chrysler or something, which was even more embarrassing. I'm told that at first I actually was put on in a velvet suit. Isn't that revolting too? And white socks or something. But, of course, you know, we all have mummies, don't we?
And what happened to you?
She sold all her jewellery to buy me a violin. And, I mean, all those sort of things. Quite remarkable. Daddy was an amateur musician, played with the Stock Exchange. He was a stockbroker, Stock Exchange Symphony Orchestra. And, in fact, they engaged me one year to be their soloist at the wonderful old Queen's Hall. And it was very, very exciting.
But one day, I think it's true, isn't it, when you were about 17 or 18, something happened which also signalled the end of this playing career. Can you tell me about that? You lost your memory.
You've done some research, haven't you? Very good, Sue. You probably mean the deciding factor, which was when I had a memory breakdown and I slipped up in the middle of the slow movement of the Mendelssohn Concerto, and which I was playing with a big symphony orchestra, and for 4 or 5 bars I was out. I got back. But when I came off the stage, I said, "That is it. That I can't afford to go through again." And that was when I made the decision to go into concert promotion. I don't regret the career as a violinist. In fact, I adored it, and I think next we're going to play a very short unaccompanied piece by the great Hungarian violinist Jaska Szigeti. My mother was determined. She adored this man. He was one of the great virtuosi of the time. And she decided that I must go to this man and be taught. And he said, "Madam, I do not teach." And she persevered for nearly 2 years. And in the end, he agreed to teach me for a lot of money, which really gave Mummy a lot of problems. But he said, "The only way is your son will have to travel with me." So I sort of travelled as an unpaid secretary, but got a lesson every so often for which he was paid.
So what is he to play on your desert
well,
island?
Well, he was, apart from other qualities, he was a world expert on Bach, and particularly the unaccompanied sonatas and partitas, of which there are 6. And I've chosen the Gavotte en Rondo from the Partita number 3. Thank you.
the Gavotte en Rondo from Bach's Partita No. 3 in E major, played by Josef Shigeti, Harold Fielding's violin teacher. So, Harold, you took to concert management instead of concert performance. Now, what and who did you manage in those early years, which must have been the war years?
Well, yes, I was put officially to be the concert manager of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. The brief was to go into the bomb cities as quickly as possible. After I'd done that for about a year or 2 years, I started to run concerts on my own. One of the first stars that I got was the great Richard Tauber. And in fact, I had Tauber under contract for 3 years for 150 concerts a year. Well, of course, that was impossible. Nobody could sing that. He was one of the most wonderful people I have ever worked with. An absolute darling, never any problem.
So at what point did you move on then, or move out from classical music into variety?
Well, then it was the time when you had people coming over to the Palladium, like Danny Kaye, for example, Bob Hope. And most of them who came to England, they either played the Palladium or they played the Palladium and my tour. Danny Kaye was an enormous success. He gave me the toughest contract I have ever paid anybody, because he demanded the biggest percentage of the receipts I have ever seen in my life. But I needed him because that name brought other names. You had to be seen to be the sort of top concert promoter of the time. But, of course, I did keep somewhat serious, because apart from Tauber and his concerts, I also got the privilege of handling all Beniamino Gigli's concerts. Now, that was my great triumph. He was the Pavarotti of the day. In fact, so enormous in box office that if we were opening a box office at 10 o'clock, I would ring it at 12, and if they didn't say we're completely sold out, I would say, well, what's gone wrong? It was that enormous.
Shall we have your third record there?
This is Richard Tauber singing Il mio tesoro from Don Giovanni, and a number which Richard almost always put into his programmes and brings back to me the most wonderful memories.
Il mio tesoro intanto andò.
Richard Tauber singing Il mio tesoro from Mozart's Don Giovanni with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Walter Gurr. So, Harold, your first big musical, that was Cinderella, I think, the Colosseum, 1958.
London Colosseum, yes.
With a popular young singer in the lead role called Jana.
Yes, that was quite an extraordinary thing. We wanted to get somebody who wouldn't normally play the role. Jana, as you remember, was very glamorous, very much at the top of her career at that time.
But it was quite a novel idea, wasn't it, to take a recording artist
and of course,
put her into
and of course Tommy Steele was Buttons. It was my first entry into the West End. The press were kind enough to say that it revived the glories of the 1900s at Drury Lane. I was also lucky in that Rodgers and Hammerstein, who never allowed their scores to be used except under their own management, I don't know how I worked it, but a lot of meetings in the Oak Room of the Plaza Hotel in New York, and they said, we'll give you the score, which was only a 1.25-hour score. They enlarged it for me to 2.5 hours. I mean, today, to mount the glamour of that show, with which I sort of made my reputation in London, would make even Ziegfeld at $3 million look cheap. I mean, it would have cost, I should think, $4 to $5 million. It had the most enormous amount of scenery. It had a singing chorus of 20, a dancing chorus of 20. I mean, it was huge in every way. I had to make my mark. And yes. In those days, getting into West End theatres was very much a closed shop.
But it was also an innovative business. I mean, the idea of transferring a pop star called Tommy Steele into a show like that was something no one had done before.
I mean, Tommy and I were in Dundee one night playing a concert, normal concert, and he got totally mobbed on stage. And they started to pull his clothes off him, and he came off. He says, "Gov," he's always called me Gov, he says, "Gov, that's it." I said, "What do you mean, that's it, Tom? What's it?" He said, "That's it. We don't do any more concerts. I'll finish the tour, but everything you've booked we'll do. Not going through that." He said, "Why can't we do musicals?"
So it was his idea,
and it was his idea, very much. Yeah. And, I mean, after that, he's done, as you know, innumerable shows for me.
Absolutely.
With the most extraordinary success.
You were mentioning just now how you bullied Rodgers and Hammerstein into letting you have the score of Cinderella. Now, who else have you nagged into submission in your professional lifetime? Sam Goldwyn, I think.
Well, again, this was, in fact, Tommy's idea that we should try and get the rights to the Hans, as it was on the film Hans Christian Andersen, with Danny Kaye, of course, and we should get the stage rights. Sam Goldwyn held those stage rights for himself, always intended to do it. We worked for some years on him, and eventually, just before he died, he said, OK, I will grant those rights to you. And we did do it very beautifully at the London Palladium.
But it also,
Tommy was magnificent in it.
But it also shows that story, all of these stories, that you are simply not a man who takes no for an answer.
Guilty, my lord.
Let's have your next record. What's that?
The next record is Juliet Prowse. I brought her here for the show which I did with Bernie Delfont at the Prince of Wales Theatre, Sweet Charity. And the song I've chosen there is If My Friends Could See Me Now. And I thought for this programme, thinking we're on a desert island, that might be appropriate.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine. I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those stumble bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, well, we look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pal, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now.
Juliet Prowse singing If My Friends Could See Me Now from Bernard Delfont and Harold Fielding's production of Sweet Charity. And if your friends could see you on a desert island, Harold, what would they see? A lost and dejected man or the eternal optimist expecting the rescue boat?
Well, I think I'd be that. I'd also be looking very, very carefully for something. I am terrified of snakes. And I would have to examine that island very carefully, as quickly as possible.
Talking about snakes, let's talk about the critics.
Oh, I say.
Do you have much regard for them? You liked that, did you?
I like that. Well, I don't... It's a very difficult situation regarding critics. I do think criticism is becoming a little strange in this country because success is not a story. Failure is a story, and it can be shattering because when you have put a new show on, you are at your lowest ebb. You've worked 18, 19, 20 hours a day for weeks. You've got really het up, and the next one you open it, it's all written awful about. It's pretty shattering.
But you've managed in the main, haven't you, to appeal to your audience over the head of the critics, as it were. You've gone straight out to the audiences and said, look, I've put this show on for you. Do you want to come in and see it?
If you've got enough money in the kitty, enough guts to do it, a cast who won't get depressed playing to very small houses, and a few other things, in my view, you can beat the critics, even if they've reviewed very badly. But it is becoming more and more expensive. I was very successful in rescuing one or two, particularly Charlie Girl, which had the worst press ever known in history. In fact, we issued so many writs the next morning, it wasn't true. We did it to get space in the, you know, do anything.
No such thing as bad publicity.
Exactly.
But you're also known as the coach party king. I mean, do you object to that title?
No, I don't object to it. I love the coach parties. They're adorable. It isn't a part of the job that I like very much. The marketing side is a bit boring, but I will tell you, Sue, very, very, very important. And you see, although Ziegfeld was not a success for reasons which I can't talk about on this programme, some of them, on simply announcing that it would be a Harold Fielding extravaganza at the London Palladium, which is my favourite theatre, and that it was based on Ziegfeld, not one name other than that. We took over £1 million.
Mm.
Now, that was a case of salesmanship that worked.
So what went wrong?
Well, it wasn't, by the time it got to the stage, and I really, without getting into a libel court, can't say some things, it wasn't the show we'd originally planned. It was very disappointing. It had wonderful qualities. I think now, with the hindsight I've got, I should have, however expensive it was, said, I need 6 weeks, pay the theatre rent to stay dark, bring in some other people I could have thought of then, change the format of the show, because one of the problems was Mr. Ziegfeld was not a very interesting person, and the interesting parts of his life weren't all that nice. Now, people don't want in a musical to sit and hear nasty things. They want to hear nice things. And, it's a sorry story, but that's past history now.
Well, I'd like to hear a bit more about it, but I'd like to have your next record, first of all. What should that be?
Well, how about having Tommy Steele? Now, may I tell you a little story about this song? It comes from Half a Sixpence. It's called She's Too Far Above Me. It was the quiet moment of the show. And it was so successful for Tommy that every show Tommy and I have done since, we've always had what we call as the Too Far Above Me number.
She's too far above me. By half she is. She'd laugh, she would. Not I, she would. If I was to say I loved her so.
Tommy Steele singing She's Too Far Above Me from Half a Sixpence, one of Harold Fielding's great successes. So what's the secret of a good musical, Harold? Good story, obviously.
It's very, very difficult to know what makes a good musical. And, of course, there is a certain change. Why Cameron Mackintosh, whom I admire enormously, is being very successful with shows like Miserables, which are quite heavy in their way, more like opera. That is a change at the moment. I still believe, though, that the people I market to, the mums, the dads, the kids, the coaches, want glamour. They want to see beautiful costumes, which I've always thought of. Much more important than scenery, because scenery they don't really look at. Costumes come right down to the footlights and they see them, and they see them swirling and so on. And it's always been one of my big things.
But, I mean, again, you gave them all of that in Ziegfeld, and they didn't come for it in the end. I mean, the most expensive musical ever mounted in Britain, wasn't
it?
Well,
the story wasn't right. I mean, we couldn't get the story right. We should have... I know what we should have done. We should have taken off for 6 weeks, abandoned the story, the book, altogether. I didn't. I still persevere with putting it on. You know, you get an idea, and I thought this is his life.
And you put a lot of your own money into that one,
unfortunately, I did, yes. Well, I've always gambled with, all through my career. I started with £100, and those concerts which cost virtually nothing, if they made £10 or £15, that was a good day in those days.
So you've always put your money where your mouth is, so to speak.
Well, I'm afraid I have, yes.
It's worked until a couple of years ago.
Well, yes, OK, we've got a little hump at the moment, but these things happen. It's very lucky. I've always had a bubble inside me. I've got a huge amount of energy. I love the challenge of all these things. I don't like disaster, of course I don't, but by God, I've had it so many times.
Has it not depressed you at all? You seem still full of energy and optimism. Has it not brought you down at all, or is this your
public
face? In private,
yes. Of course it has. Of course it has.
I wonder what your wife Maisie might have had to say about all of this now.
She would have been very cross. I don't think that I would... If she had been alive, there were certain things I wouldn't risk, and I might not have risked Ziegfeld. But she died of a heart attack in 1 minute before I could even say goodbye. And I suppose I'm living now for the shows, for everything, and I do take risks.
Shall we have another record?
Yes. Now we come to another star, that I've been very fortunate to have, who is also a wonderful friend, Michael Crawford. He's only ever done one show for me, although I hope he will do another, and that was Barnum. Michael, the thing is that in his dressing room, you daren't go near Michael, however friendly you are, for the last half hour before curtain up. He revs himself up, just like you see long-distance runners or runners on the track. He does that for half an hour before, revs up. And to be able to go out and sing this number right at the beginning of a show, you need to have appeared as if you've already been on the show and you're halfway through.
Barnum's the name, and humbug's my game. Whether you end up thinking that humbug's a blessing or a curse, you're still gonna buy it. Why? Because every 60 seconds in this world, a delightful phenomenon takes place, which absolutely guarantees it. There is a sucker born every minute.
Michael Crawford singing There's a Sucker Born Every Minute from Barnum. Well, now, there's a big house in Mayfair called Fielding House, and behind its pink front door, these shows we've been discussing have been masterminded from the initial planning and the finance and the scripting and the casting, right down to the last sequin. You've involved yourself at every stage, Harold, haven't you?
Yes, I'm afraid I have to admit that, but it's the only way I know to work. It is the true tradition of impresario as against what they call producers today, who are very often not in show business at all. They put up money, they want their name at the top of the hoarding and so on and so on. I believe that a true impresario should be into every bit of it. Not because I know better than anybody else, but somebody has to be the captain. I've always explained to new people joining me, there has to be a captain. My job, like a captain on a ship, is to make all his officers working as a team. They're carrying out all the jobs. Somebody's got to put them together. Somebody's got to have the last word, and I have never, ever allowed any director, and that's why I've lost some directors, who normally want to have complete artistic control. I said, that isn't the right way to do it. If the show goes wrong, it's my fault. Who's being blamed for Ziegfeld? Not other people, me. I do play a part. Nobody seems to object to it. And in fact, most of the people say it's good.
And what do you think all of those people whom you've employed, what would they say was your greatest fault, do you think?
Well, I can lose my temper. I can slam a phone down if I don't like the way the conversation's going. I can do lots of naughty things, but I don't know. Perhaps wanting to put on more and more musicals could be a fault. I don't know.
Let's put on more and more records. What's number seven?
Number seven is Albert Sammons, who in his day, 30, 40 years ago, was the Nigel Kennedy of the moment. In other words, the top English violinist. Before I went to Sighetti, I was lucky enough to be taken to Sammons and became a pupil of his. He, at that time, was just about to give the first performance of Elgar's Violin Concerto, for which he was regarded as the ace interpreter. And this is just a little bit of Sammons playing part of the first movement of Elgar's Violin Concerto.
Albert Sammons playing part of Elgar's Violin Concerto in B minor, Opus 61, with the new Queen's Orchestra, conducted by Sir Henry J. Wood, and that was recorded in 1929. Let me ask you finally, Harold, I think an awful lot of people believe that showbiz is a rather superficial business in which people pretend to adore each other but don't necessarily, and in the end, most of them are just there for the money. Patently, that hasn't been your experience.
I've never been in it for the money. I would have stopped doing after certain things and been a very rich man. That has never been. I love doing shows. I get a tremendous kick from doing them. Maisie enjoyed doing them. All my wonderful staff, some of whom are still with me. I mean, I've had people with me 40 years and more. That's remarkable. OK, there's a lot of false loving each other and calling each other darling and all this damn silly thing. That, of course, I don't particularly like. But one of the things I say to youngsters when they're coming into the show for the first time is, would you please remember the theatre is my factory. And in a factory, you work. And you work properly and you work hard. It isn't a game. It's very, very hard work. You've got to be prepared to be somewhat dedicated to doing it. If you can like it at the same time, if you don't like it, then get out. Because it isn't an easy job at all. And my father summed it up marvellously once when he said, well, neither of you wanted to, that's my brother, I wanted to become a stockbroker. He said, but as for you, Harold, having gone into a damn silly business where you start again 6 o'clock at night, he said, words fail me. Probably a good way of summing it up. But I have been happy. I've enjoyed it. The best moment of my life is to stand at the back of a theatre, hear the audience going out and say, I've had a wonderful time. It's a huge reward.
Shall we hear your last record now?
Yes. This is Shari Barabash with Diane Todd and the huge ensemble of the Great Waltz Company singing The Blue Danube.
Shari Barabash, Diane Todd and the ensemble of the Great Waltz Company singing The Blue Danube. One of those records you have to choose, Harold, which you'd need and treasure more than any of the others.
Solomon and the Schumann Piano Concerto, because although we only played a little bit at the beginning, the slow movement is even more calming.
And a book you must choose. You've got the Bible and you've got the complete works of Shakespeare.
I've always had a tremendous interest in the legal profession. And if you'd asked me, which you haven't, what else I might have liked to be in life would have been to be a great barrister. And Sir David Napley, the very eminent lawyer, is writing a series of books at the moment, Great Murder Trials of the 20th Century. And I think one of the most fascinating of all is Murder at the Villa Madeira, which was a great trial in London. And extraordinarily enough, a woman and a boy were jointly on trial. She was rather an elegant lady. What fascinates me about her, she was a concert pianist and violinist.
You could make a musical about it.
Maybe I should.
And your luxury, what's that to be? You have to choose something which is inanimate, just something that you would like to have there to please your soul, really, as much
as... A very, very big bag of sugar, because I'm completely mad about sugar. I eat sugar on fish, on meat, on salads, everything. I mean, restaurants who know me, the first thing they always come to, they must dress the sugar.
And how are the teeth?
All right.
Harold Fielding, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.